pals.
Welcome to the podcast, Throw in the Pals.
Woo! Woo, indeed.
Just coming in with energy.
Nice.
We're talking about Sinners. Oh, this is the podcast where we talk about movies. Love it or hate it, we debate it. Today we're debating Sinners.
Don't Ryan forget Coogler. The catchphrase.
Love it or hate it, we debate it.
Yeah, you almost forgot it.
I forgot it, and then I said it.
Good.
What's your name, man?
My name's Frank.
My name's Marcus.
My name's Tom. Barely keeping it on rails.
Yeah, thank God Tom's here to keep us all in line.
Finally. Some consistency.
The 2025 film directed by Ryan, written and directed by Ryan Coogler, starring Michael B. Jordan and a bevy of wonderful performers.
This is Michael's best work since Space Jam. I'm just going to say that now.
Michael Best Jordan.
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah, okay, you're making a Michael Jordan joke.
Yeah.
Someone had to early. I had to get in first.
And I was like, wait, he's not in the new new Space Jam, is he?
Is Michael Jordan kind of okay in Space Jam?
No.
Is my reclamation thing.
No.
He's bad.
I guess he's just better than.
But do we care? No.
No.
He's better than LeBron.
No.
You think LeBron is better than the new one?
I think LeBron's a pretty good actor.
Interesting.
Sinners 2025.
So on this podcast, we rate films out of 11. For some reason.
Just make it a good one.
Okay, I'll make it a good one. So if you hold up two fingers, obviously it's normally like the sign for two or it's the peace sign, but also two ones, looks like an 11. And if you have to like reference pussy eating, but you're doing it in a way where you're going to be physical about it,
yep.
You kind of need that as part of it.
Yep.
Yep. So, and I would say pussy eating is basically the theme of this movie. And I'm only sort of kidding. I'm basically not. Most amount of on-screen cunnilingus and references to cunnilingus in a long time in a big budget film. I think it's.
God, hang on. Real. Now, how many?
Well,
go. No, real quick.
Okay.
Say it's 11. Just say it's 11 mentions and we can move on. This is hideous. I'm so mad at you.
Stack is teaching his younger cousin.
No. Stop. It's 11 times. Great. All right. Shout your name if you like this film.
Tom.
Marcus.
Frank.
Oh,
although
well.
It's scary. Although it's scary.
How many times did you pee-pee? Was it 11?
No, I literally
tried. Just say it's 11. Just say it's 11, Frank.
You're the one who's meant to give 11s. This is your job.
You're trying to make
and
us break up.
And you made it so inappropriate.
We are the worst pals.
Like, we are not going to get... We're going to get banned from Spotify and YouTube.
For referring to pussy eating?
Yes.
Jesus, it's 2025, Frank. Maybe
you just hit our quota.
Be an ally.
Ooh.
Of who? Everyone?
Yeah.
Of your pals.
I can't
just be an ally
stand
of your pals.
You.
I know.
Do you want a quick synopsis of the film?
Yeah, go. Really.
Trying to leave their troubled lives behind, twin brothers return to their hometown to start again, only to discover that an even greater evil is waiting to welcome them back.
You just have a stroke halfway through that?
Even greater evil. And I got spooked out.
Hometown.
That first scene where the young guy walks into the church and they had the flashes of the night before.
Oh, you okay?
I was not... I knew it was going to be scary. I knew it was going to be like a spooky kind of film. I was not okay.
So just to check, I made sure we said our names. Should we say our scores as well? Do you think that'd be a good idea? Just for the structure of the pod?
Yeah, you went straight into the first scene, Frank. Like, yeah, you know where do we go from here?
Sorry.
We all loved it. Who wants to go first?
It's a 10.6.
Wow. Ooh, wow.
I think this movie
shit.
Fucking rules.
Okay, wow. Yeah.
So good.
Marcus?
10.
We should have.
Hey!
Okay. We should have gone the other way around. I'm like a
7.5.
Oh.
Yeah, that is a bummer.
Yeah, like, yeah, 10, yeah. 10, 7.5. It's good. It's spooky.
Okay.
And I don't know. I did.
It's spooky.
I warmed up to it. I think I grew confident.
Was there anything in particular you found frightening in this movie?
The vampires are scary, aren't they?
Yeah, but I mean, they're only the back-ish half of the. I've seen this,
and that opening scene.
And that opening scene. I've seen this movie three times. And
the snake. The snake in the truck.
Oh, you've seen it three.
I've seen it three. Oh, I went and saw it once at IMAX by myself. Second time with you at IMAX, Frank.
Yes.
And went and saw it the other day. You were going to come, but obviously there was difficulty during the week. But I went to a completely empty theater and watched it by myself the third
really?
Time. Which was awesome because it allowed me my performative watching that you both know about.
Well, yes. Yeah, I'm kind of glad I didn't go with you.
You have no idea.
I dodged a bullet.
It got to a certain point and I was like, I would have just been turning to Marcus just like... Like so much of this, and it'd been like, Christ.
When Tom and I saw it, it was in IMAX, which was fantastic. It was fully packed. We were sitting next to crowded on every side, so you couldn't do anything.
I had to rein it in.
You kept trying to grab me, and I said, "Don't touch me."
Where did you pee pee, Frank?
In my pants.
Oh, okay, that's okay.
All over the seat.
Yep,
fantastic.
Now, it wasn't too spooky.
It wasn't obviously.
I don't know if I would call it a particularly scary film. It uses, like, the genre, and it uses the tropes of vampirism and just, you know, some of the kind of horror
can
tropes.
Can I say, really well, by the
amazingly,
way.
But I was mostly just kind of like, oh, man, this is, like, foreboding and this is creepy. That's I was it. Never like, I'm really frightened.
When they're trying to get into the venue again and they're all like, hey, let me in, and they're not going to invite them in.
There's a tension for sure. Yeah. I don't know about scary.
Who are you talking about specifically, though? Because that happens a few times. Are you talking when Cornbread's trying to get in?
Yeah, the Cornbread one.
Cornbread's so good in this. I love that guy. Mm. Omar, can't remember his last name. Really, really fantastic dude.
Can I say, he's got a very Forrest Whitaker about him.
Oh, he does. Doesn't he? Yes, absolutely. He's like a Woods Whitaker. Like, not quite Forrest yet, but he's getting there.
Just one tree.
What was his name? Omar
Benson Miller.
Omar Benson Miller. Very funny. Very good performance.
Yeah, very. The whole cast is great.
So
Omar Benson Miller, you might know from 8 Mile or Ballers. I don't know. I recognize him from, I'm like, I've seen you just, I
who
know
is
you
he in,
somehow.
Who is he in 8 Mile?
Soul George? I don't know.
I've only seen that movie once. I think it's a good movie.
Okay. Gonna have to rewatch
it. Sinners. Hey.
Yeah.
Great fucking movie.
What a movie.
What an incredible film.
Michael B. Jordan. How do we describe this man?
I think he is one of the greatest stars on the planet at the moment.
I'd agree.
He has such, Tom, you said it off mic, aura.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Is he charismatic and talented?
He's got an air of like young Denzel about him at times. Mm-hmm. He's showing so much versatility already. And the best thing about him, I think, as an actor is that he has so much drive.
Yeah.
You know, he's hungry for it. He's a hardworking actor and he's out there doing shit, like really doing shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think it's hard to almost outside of Denzel, which I think is a good pull, even though Denzel was maybe not ever quite as action or... I mean, I suppose you've got Creed and you've got Hurricane as a bit of a predecessor there for what Michael B. Jordan's doing as well. But I do think of Denzel maybe not quite being as genre-y and maybe a little bit more sort of human drama sort of stuff. But I agree with you. I can't think of anyone else that's like Michael B. Jordan. He's very unique.
Denzel does Gladiator 2 and you're like, oh, okay.
Now that he's aged into, he's just like, whatever. I'm just going to do my silly performance in this.
But yeah, he did, Fences and... His career is pretty heavy, the August Wilson movies. Not heavy-handed, but...
The crime movies, you know.
Oh, there's the
Shakespeare's. Really grounded dramas.
What's the trilogy he's just done?
The Equalizer. That's kind of his, which didn't come about until like the 2010s, I don't think. But that was him kind of being like, I guess I better have one of these. I better have like an action series
to my
name.
I mean, he had Man on Fire, I guess, qualify. Anyway, we're talking about Denzel.
Yes. Michael B. Jordan's incredible. For people who remember, who know, he started in The Wire as Wallace.
Mm.
A heartbreaking performance when he's like 12 and he's so wonderful in that film. And then, he just kind of, it was very strange for me to go see. Yeah. Sorry, that show.
God, how dare you?
Yeah. And then the next time I remember noticing him was in Chronicle, which was in 2011. You guys remember that movie? It's about the three teenagers.
The three guys who get superheroes.
He's one of the kids.
He is too.
And I was like, oh my God, it's Wallace from The Wire. And everything I've seen him in since, I'm like, this is one of the most impressive actors.
I went from
Dane DeHaan.
Yes, it is Dane DeHaan. What a artifact is Dane DeHaan.
What an artifact.
Yeah,
that film is an artifact. That's a time capsule.
I saw him from The Wire and then didn't resurface for me until Black Panther.
Sure. Killmonger.
Which was one of the best
performances in the MCU.
Agreed.
Yep.
One of.
Yep.
Really not mustache twirly. I mean, the script really helps him in that movie, not to get too into it, but it's also directed by Ryan Coogler joint.
Mm.
And it's like Killmonger has that motivation of why the fuck are we as Wakandans hiding what we have from the rest of the world, right? Like, yes, we were afraid of being colonized, but then what we've done is we've colonized a certain commodity and we've taken something that we believe we should have sovereignty and a monopoly over.
Oh,
and so you're like,
we should share it. We could do a lot of good to the world.
He's doing it in a menacing and malicious way, but you get it and he's so charismatic.
Did we include that in our Villains Have a Point episode?
Oh, no, I don't think we did because we're too busy talking about Thanos for ages.
I think
Killmonger's really the best argument in the MCU. You're like, I kind of get it. I mean, I know why he's doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
He's still pretty brutal, but he's so good in that.
Yeah.
He's also apparently very good in the Creed movies. I haven't seen them.
They're fine. I'm a big Rocky fan, so for me it's like... I don't know. I see what they're doing. It's great for a new generation and their sort of introduction to it.
Yeah.
But he's so strong in it.
Yeah. Physically.
Physically.
Yeah, sure.
He's a boxer. And
he's- also, I just want to note, he is in the new Space Jam.
Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah.
That feels, as Michael B. Jordan. I mean, exactly like what should happen in that movie is they're like, hey, we've got a guy called Michael Jordan, basically.
I guess we should watch it and find out what joke they make.
Yeah, nah. Nah. Just a yeah, nah.
Just to keep going with the Ryan Coogler thing, Ryan Coogler has made 5 movies and his first movie was Fruitvale Station, which is with Michael B. Jordan. He's playing Oscar Gant in that, I want to say. That might not be his name, but he's playing, it is the true story of a young man who was shot by a police officer for no reason, like one of the many spate of high-profile cases around that time. Literally, so Fruitvale Station was a really interesting performance in 2013, and now we've got them working together for 4 other movies. You know, we've got them in Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, we've got Creed, and we've got this. So there's a fruitful collaboration.
It's the new De Niro Scorsese.
Yeah.
Sure.
I think so.
Like, you don't see it often that directors, the writer directors and an actor work so closely together and so well together. Like, obviously they must collaborate and it must be a really sort of synergistic sort of set, you know?
This one feels to me that Michael had a lot more say in the production value of it all and they really did collaborate. It felt a lot more even-handed because I mean, without Coogler on board, you could almost argue that it feels like Michael B. Jordan almost directed this as well as acted in it. Do you know what I mean? There's just an air about it to me that feels like he's so strong and prominent in this whole film.
I see what you mean.
He's the stand-in for the director. Like he's the surrogate where we're like, yeah, Ryan Coogler's using this guy to explore ideas that he's
a trusted sort of narrator.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's such, I mean, he's...
Thank you for articulating that. Well, I was like... Way better than what I was...
I know what you meant.
Because I was like, are you trying to discredit Ryan Coogler?
Not
I think
at all.
Obviously, his vision, it was like that's... He's one of the greatest filmmakers roaming around at this stage.
I don't know if I would have at all agreed with that until this movie. I would have said that Fruitvale Station was a really, really interesting debut and it's got some interesting ideas. I think Black Panther is one of the more successful MCU films. I think Wakanda Forever kind of sucks, but that's not his fault. Or it doesn't kind of suck, it's just whatever.
It's bad.
But it's not
it's
his
bad.
Fault.
It's not his fault.
I think he was under contract to do that, and I haven't seen Creed. So I was basically like, I like Black Panther. I think it's a good movie. This movie is, I'm so excited for everything this guy does next.
Yeah.
This movie is.
But he's earned the right, because he would have done Fruitvale Station and then Black Panther, which is lauded as the greatest, except for like Iron Man and Infinity War.
Yeah.
The greatest MCU movie. Now he has, you would assume, free reign to do whatever he wants because the studio went, this is going to make money and it's a unique creative idea and we can let this guy sort of do it because now he has name recognition and now he has actors who want to work with him. So he'll get incredible cast moving forward as he has for Sinners and the studios will be like, yeah, cool. Here's $200 million. Make whatever you want. He's earned that now.
Let's talk about the film.
Let's talk about Sinners, hey?
Let's talk about the film itself.
So there's a couple of vampires roaming around. Spooky stuff.
So this is a film effectively about black oppression and then it switches into and changes genre halfway through the film into a really great vampire horror film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think continues to be about, I think it's always about, you know, African-Americanism in Mississippi at this time and the black experience. It's obviously about music. Mm-hmm. It's about colonization. It's about Christianity. It's about temptation. It's about all these different things. Mm. It's a film of dual purposes. Hey, dual lead performance. What's up with that? Turns out that might be symbolic of something, Frank. You learned something today.
I wasn't listening.
Their names are Smoke. Their names are Smoke and Stack.
Yep.
It's a twin performance by Michael B. Jordan. It's an incredible fucking performance. Like, so good.
I thought you were talking about Dua Lipa.
Yeah.
And I was like, she's not in this. No. Did she do a song for the soundtrack? What are you talking about?
I can see how you got there.
Yeah, because he said Dua Lipa.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was going to
order. Sorry to interrupt your train of thought.
I was going to get you a beer and I wanted one as well. So I went up and ordered a dual IPA, and then you saw that written down and you thought it was Dua Lipa.
That's actually not bad.
Because we're
actually
not bad. No,
it's bad.
Michael B. Jordan is giving a performance, of distinction in this when he's playing Smoke and Stack.
At not one point do you go, which one's that?
Always.
You always know which one's
which. Even without the color coding, though, they do a good job of very quickly establishing the blue and the red hat, the gold the grills that that yeah, but the Stack
attitude
has.
The attitude is so different. It's
it
really
is
good.
It is tricky to do these sort of like one actor playing twins moments because you look for, like I me personally I look for the overlaps in dialogue. I look for how logistically they've done this.
Mm.
I did find that with Sinners, the dialogue it wasn't very flowy between the two, and it's very difficult to do, I'm sure, on a technical standpoint, because you have to have line cut between the two. On occasion you would have both of them in the one shot conversing, but you would never, very rarely would you see their dialogue overlapping to the point that it felt very natural. It's probably my only criticism.
I mean, technically that wouldn't be that hard to do.
And
I don't think I noticed that, but
I think I was looking for it, and so maybe it's a weird gripe to have, and it doesn't even count. But I
think they complete each other in a way that precludes them having to interrupt each other. Like they are so in sync in this film, and they are so
remind you of anyone?
Yeah, absolutely.
Not us.
Yeah, I think they're really good at knowing and detecting what the other's going to say. You know, I think they have such a symbiotic relationship.
With each other. I thought we were almost there.
Each other's sandwiches.
I do think, Tom, you said this when we watched it, like the first scene where you see Smoke and Stack leaning against the car, having a cigarette, sharing the cigarette.
Mm.
You can't see the stitch. You can't see where it's put together. You can't see who's the
almost
double.
Almost show offy, but every time I'm just like, woo! Like when he just hands him the cigarette.
Yeah. It's pretty good. I mean, like, that's the day and age we live in, right? Like the special effects, if they have time to do it, can do anything.
Yeah.
Like that's
And they are
amazing.
A trade-off of each other, you know? They're restraint and temptation. They are like I wouldn't say like light and dark is the right way of looking at Smoke and Stack, but they are business and pleasure, right? They do represent that flip side. Even just in the way they move when you see them discover the snake on the back of their truck and Stack throws the knife to Smoke and he stabs it. And it's like, yeah, these guys are like, there's a mechanism to the way that they work that is so beautiful and well realized.
Yeah.
You have so much of the movie in the first hour-ish is them apart. We've only seen them share two scenes together. And we're like, I get it. I fully understand these guys. You have given me as much as I need to invest in their relationship.
Yeah.
And now showing them separately the business and pleasure trade-off.
But they're all like, they know how to work together. They know how to separate, like divide and conquer, right?
Yeah.
They set out with their two different plans. They go and they get it done.
This is it. Smoke's more stern. He's more austere. He's more down the middle. He goes to get the materials they need for the night. He goes to make sure they don't get robbed. He shoots people if they get in the way.
Mm.
Meanwhile, what's Stack doing? He's teaching pussy eating. That's what he's up to that day.
Okay,
and he knows that's going to pay off later.
Tom's favorite bit.
It does. It comes up so much in this movie and it's incredible.
It really does, Tom, but I wish you hadn't opened the episode with it. You know what I mean?
I see what you mean.
Like, no, I'm glad he derailed the episode so
early.
If
this is someone's first episode, they are offended, they are shocked, and they're turning us off.
I think they're like, oh my goodness, and looking over their shoulder.
Yeah,
and they're just
their
kind
family,
of turning up.
And they're fanning themselves slightly because they get a little hot under the collar.
If a 1920s family is listening to this by the wireless, they are scandalous.
Sitting down as a family in their evening radio.
Yes. Regardless, I think that, and then Stack goes off and he recruits Delroy Lindo, who plays Delta Slim. You know, he goes and gets Cornbread, and his methods are so much less methodical. Methodical methods, great. His methods are so much less precise. They're so much more, much looser, right? The way he recruits Delroy, it's like he's got the beer, he's willing to put the money up. The way he gets Cornbread is by insulting him. Fuck you and fuck your wife. Like, and then somehow manages to turn that into a recruitment.
But isn't he an old friend?
Because it's only because of the wife.
I think so, but he knows that's going to work.
He always
has that confidence that he's got the right approach. It's also the scenes where we meet the love interests. So we've got Smoke going to meet Annie, and we've got Stack meeting Mary at the train station, and the trade-off between those, where there's a tragedy, a shared loss of a child, and returning to that heartbreak between Smoke and Annie. And then with Mary, again, I didn't write this movie, guys. It's not my fault. One of her first lines is, but then you stuck your tongue in my coos and fucked me so hard I thought you changed your mind. And you're like, whoa, this is a different vibe. These guys have a different thing going on.
It's also interesting coming from Hayley Steinfeld, whom we know from like Pitch Perfect and Hawkeye. You know what I mean? Like,
I only know her from True Grit, and it's one of the greatest performances ever. She's really good in this.
She's great in Hawkeye. She's great in Pitch Perfect.
She's actually very good in Hawkeye.
I've never seen Pitch Perfect.
Also, when you say Annie, do you mean Beatrice?
I don't believe so. Isn't Annie played by Owumi Osaka?
She's not listed.
So there's a way in which Coogler, the Coogs, you were calling him.
Coogler.
Yep. You know, he bisects the narrative and lets these guys explore the place that they've come from, right? Obviously, they've left. They've gone to Chicago. They've returned. They are...
Did they work for Capone? Did I catch that right?
I think that, like... It seems like they would have in the 30s, right? In
Chicago. I swear that's what they say.
Must have been a Capone thing,
You've
right?
seen it three times, so...
Yeah, but
I don't think they say. I think it's like alluded to.
Italian wine and the Irish whiskey. So they must have, like... They robbed them both.
What are the two? I don't know. I feel like I haven't pulled this from thin air.
I don't think you're wrong. I think he says Capone at some point. I'd literally just spilled something myself gesturing then. But it's okay. I won't even... Isn't that embarrassing?
You are right. It is Annie.
It's Annie. Fantastic.
Yeah. Great.
Wunmi Mosaku is so good.
Wunmi Mosaku. Yeah, sorry.
Not Wunmi.
No. I think I said her. Very good.
Yes. She's so good.
I think I said her name wrong.
I know I keep talking about Marvel stuff, but have you seen Loki? She's so good in Loki.
Mm.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah. You haven't seen it? That's such a shock to me.
Okay.
Do you know why I love this film, Tom?
Go on, Marcus.
Do you know what other film it reminds me of?
Babylon?
Was that a serious answer?
It reminds me of Babylon in a lot of ways.
What? No, this film to me...
Actually.
Whilst being...
I love winning Frank over by doing nothing. What the fuck? You know, I see his point.
Yeah.
Whilst I think this is easily the better film, it's got a Dusk Till Dawn
100%
feel to it.
I think it's definitely drawing on from Dusk Till Dawn.
The one where Tarantino drinks off Selma Hayek's foot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a... Ugh.
Guiltiest wank I've ever had.
No.
Yeah, I agree with Frank. That's not true.
No, there's no way. Actually, no, yeah.
Yeah.
No, you're right.
I'm cutting that.
It's got From Dusk Till Dawn vibes. It's also
PG.
It literally lifts a scene directly from The Thing, and I don't care because it's a really great scene. But in The Thing, Kurt Russell ties everyone up. And he tests their blood to see if they're the thing. Remember, he gets a bigger blood.
You're talking about the garlic.
The garlic. Literally, it's like, this is the thing. And that's fine. I don't care. Like, great. If you're going to do it, do the thing.
And they do it well.
It's really fun. They always find an opportunity to explore Smoke's severity and his willingness to use violence as a corrective force. And they always find an opportunity to pursue Stack's horniness and like willingness to just have a good time.
Yeah.
And so, even in that scene where Smoke smacks, he's already threatened to shoot Sammy with a gun at some point, and then he just hits him in the side of the head because, of course, he's threatening Pearlene if she doesn't try the garlic. But yeah, I mean, this is a horror movie in its influences, but it's also got a lot of influences in blues music, obviously. There's a lot of Robert
God,
Johnson and Muddy Waters and stuff like
that. Can we talk about the dance sequence
in
the middle of the film? That is one of my favorite sequences.
Before we do, I think to preempt that, we need to talk about Miles Caton.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's Caton. I believe it's Miles Caton.
Okay.
He... has such an incredible. He's relatively young, slender looking guy.
I think he's 19 when they shot this. They say introducing, and it is one of those great debut performances.
Yeah.
He's so fucking great in this.
And Michael B. Jordan is the audience when he sings in the car. He's like, oh, I got this little song working on. Plays and his slide guitar and has this incredibly thick, rich blues voice. And Michael B. Jordan is, what does he say? He's just like, woo!
We're gonna make some money. I remember saying
but
to you
thinks.
When we came out, I'm like, one of my favorite shots, and I'm so glad that Coogler finds an opportunity to use it twice, is he's playing and when he starts singing and it's the reaction shot of Michael B. Jordan, and he's just so captivated, but like it's so hard to convey a shock that looks that genuine where he's like, I would never have expected this.
Because it's his little cousin, right? And they haven't seen him for years, and he's grown up and now he's this amazing musician. And the movie doesn't work if he's not that good.
Even 100%. His speaking voice is so beautiful. So
he sounds kind of like that, but I've watched a couple of interviews with Miles Caton. Mm. He's a little bit higher pitched, a little bit less drawly. And then I've watched some interviews with Ryan Coogler and I'm like, oh, he's doing a Ryan Coogler impression. Like, he kind of is making himself sound more like Ryan Coogler in the movie, which is a great pull.
It's
That's
a little
good
jarring
choice.
Just the way he looks and then the voice that comes out, all of a sudden you're
you
like,
don't
whoa.
Expect it.
He's,
you
a young, expect it. He's a young kid, but
yeah, he's so good.
He's so good in this. You wanted to talk about the,
oh, well, you have to.
Maybe
right? So
the greatest scene in the history of cinema.
So when he starts playing in the venue and it moves into this... this time warp. I don't know how else you describe it.
Actually, at the start, you want to talk about how they talk about these special people in cultures who, when they sing and when they're making music, are drawing from spirits and other times and are connecting sort of parallel universes and all this thing and opening up portals and crazy stuff. Or
and
how it, you want to
it's the
it.
Most surreal sequence I think I've ever seen.
And I
and
did
it, you know, actually, fuck, do you know what it's like? I've just occurred to me. It's that awesome music clip that...
Fatboy Slim?
No. This is America.
Don't joke.
Donald Glover.
Gambino.
Yeah. Gambino. Yeah, it's got a. It's definitely got.
It's
that.
It's got that feel to
yeah.
it.
Yeah, pieces I know exactly just coming in, all the different cultures coming.
Yeah,
in.
Yeah, and this the rotating camera, and you're seeing everything just happening. Like it's choreographed so well.
Yeah,
and it's simple, right? Because the camera's facing this way. So then, who's behind you is the 1980s guitarist, and then he's in shot, and it's like it would be really simple to do.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah,
and then it pans up, and the roof's on fire.
There is a lot of bodies in there, though. Like that it is impressive.
It's I'm not saying it's not well done. It's just like it's like classic simple trick photography.
It's of course, like tightrope absurdity as well. Like it is one of those things.
Wasn't sold when it first started. I was like,
it is one of those things where you could imagine mishandled a beat. It's like, this is a bit silly. You're going a bit grand with this. You've got like girls dance, like twerking, and one part you've got people that are obviously meant to be of like Eastern origin. You know, once you cut to the Asian couple, and you've got a few things that you just the guitarist, like you've said, the electric guitar. You just be like, is this going to look silly, Ryan?
It's going to end up looking stupid, like Babylon. But
no, Babylon's good.
Yeah.
Well, we can talk about that later. Again, talking about the music and the sound design and the atmosphere that is created in this film. And like, we saw it on IMAX, so like the sound was just enveloping you. And it just builds from like a guy playing a blues song, stomping his foot on a stage. Simple, basic, wonderful.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, the room is shaking.
Yeah.
And you are covered in sound.
I think, honestly, on paper, this film to me doesn't, I don't know how to say this, it doesn't feel like it deserves to be as good as it is. Like, you read the synopsis and you're like, what are we doing here?
I thought the trailers made it look perfectly. I was like, oh, it's a horror picture. Like, it's a genre. It's probably going to look pretty cool. I'll go see it in IMAX.
Yeah, it'll be like a fun vampire romp.
It's way too clever for its own good.
When I walked out of this, I could not believe how emotionally intelligent it was and how like well pitched at its extremity. How from that scene onwards, where Preacher Boy first plays, basically for the rest of the movie, I'm at varying heights of like, this is some of the most transcendent cinema ever made. Like, I love this movie so much that I can pinpoint the handful of moments that I'm like, I really wish I loved that more. And it's not even anything that ruins the movie for me, but there are moments where I'm like, that's why it's not quite a perfect movie to me. That's why it's not
Hayley
quite a
Steinfeld
perfect movie
spitting
to me.
In his mouth.
I think maybe 12 out of 11, right? Like, how much can we go?
And
so good that the reaction to "Babe, you're drooling" is "You want some?"
Yeah.
And then she spits in his.
He just.
You know it's real.
I mean, you gotta. How else are you going to do it?
You can't just go.
People out there buying bath water, I think this is like normalized almost.
That's so true, actually. In the 1930s as well.
The prosthetics.
Like, that girl probably has like the nastiest.
Well, they're not,
the
dental hygiene. Gingivitis.
Gingivitis. The body horror, and once everyone gets shot or transforms and all this stuff, the prosthetics or special effects are pretty gruesome.
But it continually returns to a film about music and a film about how music is shaped by heritage and culture, and culture shapes music.
And do you think also, like, family?
I think so, or
brotherhood.
100% it's about
the family.
It's about intergenerational stuff. It's about what we inherit, and it's not just about racial and ethnic and cultural things. It's about familial stuff. It's why your daddy's a preacher, our daddy was a bad man. We can't go to Mount Bayou. They won't accept us there because of the legacy we carry. You can be a preacher boy. And the point is that the true sublimity of life exists in the middle.
Here
you
goes.
Can't be extreme on one side.
Mate, you really ramped up quick.
Christianity and the high-minded virtue signaling, and you can't be, or just virtuous, not virtue signaling, and you can't be the extremity of the depraved, the damned, the 1,200-year-old Irish vampire. But somewhere right in that mixture between the end of the day where the light kisses the horizon and it goes orange, and you have two twins who are men who make each other better by their distinctions. Their virtue is that they share something, but there is one thing or two things different about them that makes them better men because of their proximity to each other. And it's why when Stack dies in Smoke's arms, Smoke sits up and says, "Best thing about me was him." And it's the most emotionally devastating thing that this man lost a piece of himself.
Oh, you sly devil! You caught me monologuing.
It's the second. It's the second most emotionally.
I know what the one for you is.
Oh, go. What's the first?
The first one. Oh my god! I can't even talk about it without sobbing.
No,
at the end of the film, when Smoke has been shot, finally.
Yeah.
And he's sitting on the ground. He's having a cigarette, and he looks over, and now that he's dying, he sees his partner, Annie. That's right.
Mm.
And she's holding their son. Yep. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And she's
so amazing.
You know what she says to him, which I didn't actually get until the third time?
What's she say?
Because this movie, as I monologued about, is about the Smoke and Stack are
so
representative of, yes, the weird tension within this era, the meeting place, the nexus between depravity and virtue. And that they, without one another, cannot really attain, I don't know, the truth of who they are, right? Like the loss of one kind of derides or deprives one of part of who they are. But Smoke can achieve some sort of grace in death, one, through killing the clan members, but two, also through passing on to Sammy, like, take this and bury it. Go do something with your life. Like, I can't do that anymore. I've lost my brother. But then when he's smoking the cigarette and he sees Annie with their child in the afterlife and she says, "If you put that cigarette out, you can hold him. I don't want him getting any of that smoke on him." And it's not smoke anymore. It's Elijah, right? Like he's transcended smoke. He's transcended that criminality and that aspect of himself.
It's so good.
Because he's become Elijah, much as Stack is Elias, right? You know, and maybe is no longer able to access that.
I'm just like, really?
Do you know, and this is back on what you said before, this is one of those scenes where it could have been like, it's
so
a tightrope.
This could have been
cheesy.
The Iron Claw.
It could have been the Iron Claw. Thank you.
Now, see, I love that scene in the Iron Claw, but I understand more why people don't like that scene.
This is the better version of that.
I agree.
Absolutely.
This is definitely the better version, even though I like the
Iron
Claw.
I would say not that that's bad. I don't think that's bad. I think, and Zac Efron did his best with what he could. This is one of the greatest moments in cinema in the last 10 years.
Not to be a nitpicker, but it's Jeremy Allen White in that scene, right?
Oh, you're talking about
when he crosses into the afterlife.
I was talking about Zac Efron crying with his kids.
Yes, but that's
afterlife. Actually, I take it back. That moment is bad.
Yeah, I thought you thought that.
Yeah.
I kind of think it works. But anyway, yes, that's a beautiful scene.
The guy that's on the ground that he shot, like, speaks to him and takes him out of it, you see him snap out of the moment, and it's almost like, how dare you take him away?
Listen, I got money. Just like empties a clip into him.
Dead.
Very
so
satisfying.
Such a cathartic moment.
But the fact that the clan is in this is an interesting distinction between O'Connell, who plays Remick. Jack O'Connell.
Very good.
Cook from Skins years ago.
Mm.
Got a really interesting legacy sort of to him now. And
I think it's chef to you, not cook.
Your chef.
You proud of that?
I'm okay with that.
All right. He's fantastic in this.
Yes, and me for one second.
You're right.
You're proud of that?
I'm sorry.
Jeez. Jack O'Connell is very good.
Remick is very good. But the point is, I think I got to a stage with this movie when I watched it the first time where even to the degree that I was enjoying it, I can tell you one of the lines in the movie. I said before that there are moments that I go,
you can tell Tom's seen this three times and Marcus and I have only seen it once. And we're like, yeah, it's pretty good. And Tom's like, you know that line?
That one line
at 1 hour 20.
No, but this, you can watch it once and do that. That's his superpower,
Big brain Tom, we call him.
Yeah, I know.
Big brain. I think that
no capacity for the rest of life. Just
no capacity.
Just timestamps.
Don't do Rayman.
Tom, watch movie.
Yeah.
Tom no drive.
Tom no drive.
Tom no job. Money.
Continue.
I apologize.
Where are you going? Go back to your beautiful monologue.
Oh, Remick. I couldn't remember what I was talking about. Remick is a representation you think when you first see him, you're like, oh, right, when he shows up at Lola Kirk, and I can't remember the other guy's name, but he shows up at that southern couple's door, he sees the clan robes, and you think, oh, he sees that, so he recognizes, oh, these guys will sympathize with, like, these guys are racist just like me, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
You think he's going to be a little like that. And you're like, yeah, I get it. The movie's playing on his white people are vampires and they have sucked the soul out of black music and they have made it their own. They've commodified
Elvis.
It.
Yeah, Elvis.
All this
no,
sort of
I was going to say, like, I kind of thought when he rocks up, I was like, maybe he's a good guy. Something about his face. I know. But I was like, he kind of looks likeable.
He's on fire.
Can you imagine
I know,
but that guy showing up to the door?
Yeah.
And you're like, honey, can we let this nice young man in?
I didn't know who the vampires were yet. I thought Smoke and Stack were going to be vampires. And that's how they got the money.
Yeah.
So just to be very clear, though, when you see him running towards the house and he's charred, basically,
charred on fire,
the back.
Fully burnt. I thought, I mean, obviously
you
he's
thought
a
he was
vampire.
Victim to some
I,
like, sort
yeah,
of
I thought he'd been
accident.
Attacked by something.
Gotcha. Okay.
I was wrong.
No, hey,
and it's okay to
fine.
Admit that.
That's fine.
But I
no
think
judgment.
Maybe the expectation is the movie's
he has
gonna,
a likable face.
He does. The movie's going to play with that symbolism of vampires as colonization of white oppression.
Yeah.
And as the movie goes on, you're like, this guy's... It would be wrong to say that Remick is woke, but this guy is not racist. He's more like when they're like, y'all clan? And he's like, sir... We believe in equality. Like, he's so quick to be like, not me.
Don't pay me with that,
bro. And you're like, he feels like a I don't see color sort of guy where you're like, that's still bad. But he's also a 1,200-year-old Irish vampire. He legitimately isn't racist.
No, because he's seen everything. And all he wants is he just hates
just
people
about,
who-
about unifying everyone in the vampire
and
race.
And he
right?
makes it sound good. The key scene to the movie is
it
when he comes
good.
To the side of the door and he's like, look how happy Stack is now. Look how happy Mary is. We're all just chilling.
Their harmonies are stunning.
We'll go kill the rest of the clan. Yeah. Don't you want that? And it's like, kind of. Yeah. Like, this is the best argument I've heard
be
for vampirism.
A fun Irish
and
vampire who sings
they're
and
doing
dances
the jig
in
the
moonlight. Go do a jig.
They have communal thought and they all know each other. Like
people have posted that that gif online of him finishing his Irish jig and all the black extras coming over and cheering off for him. Everyone's like, this must be so good for that white boy. he looks so excited. But yeah, I love the Irish jig that he does. I love that he gets more Irish as it goes on to
so
start
that, with. That's my question. Is he is putting on this southern voice.
I believe so. I think he's basically like, it would sound weird if I sounded as Irish as I actually am in this setting.
I don't think it's there's no transition. It just snaps. All of a sudden he's Irish.
He does it when he's specifically for one scene when he becomes really Irish. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. He's reciting it the way he learnt it when the British colonization. He could be however many hundred years old. It wouldn't matter. It's always Irish, the British occupation of
so
Ireland.
So Tom, when we saw it, you were like, yeah, his accent's a bit shaky, isn't it? That's what you said to me.
I did. And
so you've come to a realization that, oh, no, that was a choice.
I basically think that he's doing his accent from...
I need to turn your mic down. You are, like, coming in so hot,
I'm sorry. I think he's doing his accent from Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which is his stage show, the version they did.
I've not seen it. Is it about a cat?
You'll never believe what kind of roof they put the cat on.
It's so hot.
It's made of tea.
Go on.
Is that where they...
No, don't continue.
Please continue. You want to say Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Jack O'Connell's in a production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof where he plays Brick, I think, whatever the main guy in that it's called. And he's like, do you say something, Maggie? And you're just like, I don't know, Jack. You sound like you're from London. he's English. He's Northern English Irish.
Yeah.
And so you're like, that accent's pretty weird. And then I realize that's basically what he's doing for Sinners, but it works the more you go, yeah, he's kind of putting that on. Like, it's not a real accent. Yeah. He also has like five different accents as like the Irish when he's reciting the Lord's Prayer, but also both times he says, Sammy, where it's like he doesn't say anything else like that the whole movie, but he goes full Adam Sandler in that one bit.
We all do voices.
He goes full Denzel in Gladiator 2.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just playing a Brooklyn guy.
He's so great. But now, yes, he does represent that
also
idea.
Good, like, again, the singing. Their singing is like, it's bad music, but they sound good.
The Irish music.
Yeah.
I think Wild Mountain Time, their performance of it, Lola Kirk and Jack, and I cannot remember the other guy's name, I feel terrible. I think their performance is lovely of Wild Mountain Time.
But compared to the rest of the music,
obviously
it's like,
not.
A little bit, but they even acknowledge it in the film. They're like, mm-hmm.
I love Pick Poor Robin Clee.
Yeah.
It's such a fucking goofy song. And then when they do the That Jay Bird and they move their instruments choreographed.
There's a real, Brother, Where Art Thou?
100%. It's got a bluegrass feel to it.
Yeah.
But it also is like, you get when she goes out, it would have been so easy for Hayley Steinfeld, to go out and sit with them just while they were plucking away.
Yeah.
But no, you go out and they do a full 2-minute performance and it's lovely. And you're like, we like these guys, right?
Yeah.
Like
it's
much more interesting because I get it. They seem like a nice folk, but also just a little too, you know, they give us the willies.
And do you know what? Like, and for me, it was like, oh, like Hayley Steinfeld's like, all right, you're drooling, I'm going to go. Mm. And you just see that little scene of him just jump in the air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He got up behind him.
And then it cuts. And you're like,
this is, so we haven't talked about it really, but, and Frank, I don't know how well versed you are in the vampire genre or the vampire lore, but
he knows how to vamp.
I think that this.
Go on, vamp.
Play that bar over and over. Play that bar over and over till you're ready to come in with your dialogue. I'll keep playing that bar over
just and over. Just tell me when to sing. Tell me when to come in.
Let him go.
And you missed it.
Where do I come in?
So. The vampires.
That's
in this,
a bad bit for anyone. That's like, why do we do that? Wow.
Tell them it's a bad bit. That'll get them back on our side. We agree that was bad. All right.
Some of our best work.
My mic is loud.
Yeah. No, you're loud.
I'll go back.
The vampires in this are really, really good. And they take every trope and cliche with the vampire lore and genre and play into it and commit to it so well. The whole needing to be invited inside, the garlic, the teeth, the flying, that it's all there. They give you every aspect of it and it doesn't feel campy or cringy at any moment for me.
Well, they don't feel the need, as for some reason Nosferatu, the recent Robert Eggers one, which was okay, I thought was all right. Mm. The thing I kind of resent about that movie is how much of it is spent going like, it seems like this victim's blood has been drained and the creature only comes out at night. And they spend an hour and it's like, it's a vampire. We all know what vampires are.
Now,
and this movie goes, I'm going to explain to you what vampires are in 3 minutes. We're going to have a montage. We're going to get ready to fight them. And I'm going to say everything you already know just to get it out of the way. And we're done.
Well, it's because like, yes, in some films, the rules are different.
Yes, but this one goes, every rule you've heard is in play. Yeah. That's it. Everything you know, it's there.
It's like, it's the classic ones.
How does Annie know?
Well, Annie's presumably got some, like, because down in the bayou and down in sort of like Mississippi, down in Louisiana, there were a lot of sort of what was kind of like voodoo.
Oh, so adjacent. This is like a side story to Interview with a Vampire. So they are connected. It's the same universe.
Yeah.
Definitely. 100%. Definitely connected. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Don't you remember the scene in this where Brad Pitt was awful? The Interview with a Vampire. But yeah, she knows about all that because she has, and of course she's got her amazing scene where she's introduced with Smoke and she explains to him in one of the, you're right, Frank, that probably the most emotionally potent thing aside from Smoke and Stack, which I love, is the backstory with Annie and their child. And she says to him when he's like, I've been all over this world. I've seen people die in ways you wouldn't believe. I never seen no magic. I never seen no ghosts, none of that.
Yeah.
Just power and money. And she says, you're a fool. You come back here with two legs, two arms, two eyes and a working brain and you don't think that I've been spending my magic and my efforts every day to keep you alive.
And you wear that chain around
and you wear that chain around your neck that I put all my herbs and my special material in there for you and you don't think that will keep you safe. And it cuts to him and it's the first time we've seen Smoke emotional in the film and he goes, then why didn't it work for our baby then? It's sad.
It's ridiculous in a film about vampires how well that lands.
I had a question about when, is it Stack goes to bite Smoke at the end of the film?
Yes, and that's why
and
he can't.
The necklace.
Because the necklace stops him.
Yeah.
Gotcha. It's so good. And then, of course, at the end, he takes it off and he puts his dog tags back on.
Gotcha.
Because I got to be a soldier now.
Gotcha.
What a movie.
Really great. Now, there's a scene right before the vampire's breach, we're going to call it.
Oh, yeah, the breach.
This is what I wanted to talk to you about.
Save it, Private Ryan.
Don't say breach.
It's like where it goes into what we're calling a widescreen And I don't know how to describe it, though.
Aspect just when ratio. It, the aspect ratio, it opens yeah, up. Like, when it's an IMAX, up. It just...
Well, that's the thing, because it's not all for IMAX.
No. So no. It, but, like, almost changes. Every film,
but there's like, that moment sequences. Is cinematic genius to yeah. have that wide shot of the group lining up.
When they do
up.
Their hero shot.
Yeah.
So here was something I said to Frank on the day that I was like, I think this is close to a perfect movie. There's one thing that really pisses me off about it. Mm. And it's that in that hero shot, you have two... random guys on the right
bodies.
And one random guy on the left. And you're like,
oh, I didn't even realize.
Where have they been the whole time? Having watched it a third time now, they are actually in the juke joint with them when they're doing the test with the garlic and when they're doing like everything else. They are just in the background in a way where they're barely acknowledged. I think that's a flaw. I think Coogler should have just kept it to the main six. I do not think he needed
either include them or don't.
Yes,
basically.
three extra random bodies in the room that I just find distracting. It's one of my.
Was it to make the fight look more
I
fair?
I think so. Obviously. It's like if we have all these vampires running in, how are they going to hold them off?
Because they're pretty powerful. Like
they barely hold them off.
I mean,
it is a slaughter.
I would say they do all right.
Are you serious?
The fact that they don't all die in 25 seconds.
It kind of feels like they do. It literally feels like in the first 25 seconds of their fight, they've lost.
Yeah. Let's go with...
They're never going
to
win. But
Bo and... That's embarrassing. I can't remember her name now. The actress's name is Lee Jun Lee, and she plays Bo's wife in it. And she... Grace. Bo goes out and goes to come back, and obviously he's been turned into a vampire, and he says, we're going to go pay Lisa a visit. Right. Mm. By the way, Jack O'Connell speaks to her in Mandarin, Cantonese. I can't remember. He speaks to her in their dialect. And I don't know if you guys remember what he says.
No.
I even know the way you like to be licked. This is the theme of the movie. Pussy eating is like just in there so significantly you cannot get away from it. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Moment to moment. And Frank looks mad.
I am a bit. Because you might be right.
Because now I'm considering.
And I wish you just hadn't opened the episode so aggressively.
Oh, you're right. I apologize. But regardless.
He doesn't want a cunny like this. Do you know what I mean?
Hey. No. No. I thought about it.
It's cunning to link these together.
I love that you almost validated my worst joke.
Can I tell you my Drake line I came up with?
Yeah.
Yeah, go.
All I talk is money and pussy, money lingus. Thank you, Marcus.
Is that not a real Drake, though?
It sounds like it should be, yeah, right? Yeah, I feel like funny. If I send that to him, he'd send me like $200 back.
Jim, that's optimistic.
Yeah, that's true. But anyway, the fact that there is an arc in this movie for almost every character who gets significant screen time, and for Grace, it's her relationship with both her daughter, Lisa, and then she's so frightened she's got the child that's going to be threatened by the vampires. Them trying to stop her and her screaming, come on in then, you motherfuckers, is such a powerful moment. And then her death, she runs past everyone straight to Bo on fire and stabs him through the heart, and it cuts back to her twice immolated screaming as she's stabbing him. And you're like, this is some of the most horrendous shit, and it's beautiful, and it's so upsetting.
Yeah.
I love that. I love, obviously... Stack turning Annie and her going, not you, and then Smoke having to kill her. And he says, I love you.
Yeah, this movie is so emotionally resonant.
It's so emotional.
It doesn't make sense. Because it's such a fun, it's fun, right?
It is pretty fun.
Even when
it's
spooky, scary.
It's ludicrous at times.
Yeah, it's outrageous. It's massive. It's silly. It's like campy vampires.
Yeah.
Yet.
Campires.
Great. Great stuff. Good,
Marcus,
good joke.
Stop laughing.
Good joke.
You are part of the problem. Yeah.
I just realized this now.
Keep validating it.
I gotta stop giving you the satisfaction. Sorry. Continue.
How is it so emotionally resonant? I don't know how it does it. I don't know how it flips the switch so quickly between everything.
This is why it's Babylon to me. It's a movie I hold in
what
very.
I mean,
one's good and one's bad. I guess that's the same.
Yeah, Smoke and Stack, good and bad. You know, what do you
think with that? I think Babylon 1 is a movie that uses its music in a very particular and very hefty way that very few movies do, and this movie does as well. But I also think that they're movies about excess. They're movies about the fact that to have something good or have something worthwhile, it may involve a deal with the devil. It may involve engaging with things.
Do you know
what
Tom and that film have in common?
They
never
long?
Shut the fuck up.
They both Babylon.
See, that's good.
That's
Thank
good.
You.
That's
you
good.
Get it?
I do think we made that joke several times in the episode.
But we needed it.
We needed it back.
To
but
stop you.
I also think...
Do you want to go in the pantry at all?
It is the extremity of the movie that still makes it like resonate, even though it's too much. We could go in the pantry if you want to go in the pantry.
I don't want him to talk anymore.
No,
but I
that's
guess,
what that is.
Yeah, we, but
the
we
pantry? Is that right?
It's a device to make him talk more. Let's I don't do know it. Why you're like, let's do it.
I love the risk.
The butler in a pantry with a mic. The butler's pantry.
We've given up in the middle bit
Pop
there.
The cork.
Ryan Coogler's deal for this
so
movie.
So do you have anything? You start with a, what are you doing here?
Kugler.
The Kugs. Kugels for this movie.
You do your Kugels every day?
I do my Kugels every day, of course. The Kugler for this movie has a deal, had a deal, where he got
the devil.
Final cut. I mean, first dollar royalties, first dollar gross.
What does that mean for the listener?
It means that the
studio- He gets
studio,
the first dollar.
He gets the first dollar, profit. That's it. The studio doesn't have to go into profit or it doesn't have to reach a certain margin. Or maybe if it does, it's much lower than usual. It doesn't always actually mean he gets gross off the first dollar, but it's closer than it normally would be rather than it having to hit like
Way to explain that so badly.
Okay, he makes money earlier than other directors would.
There you go.
And he Thank also you. Gets the rights of the film reverted to him in 25 years.
Yeah, which everyone thinks is just like a gimmick, but I think it's more of a
it's
a statement.
It's the movie. The movie is about black people having ownership over their art,
yeah,
and avoiding it being diluted by the powers that be. He made the movie about the deal he got to make the movie. It's fucking genius. It's incredible what he's done with this, where he's made
it's
a property.
Like Inception.
Yeah, kind of. Sinception.
Kind of.
Yeah,
but not.
Inners.
Yeah, but it's yeah. It is. It is very interesting that he got that deal. He got $90 million to make this movie. And also, for whatever reason, people treated it like... It was so weird when this film came out, as you guys probably remember. And I think Variety was the most notorious one.
Oh, yes.
But
yes,
there
yes.
were film publications.
Lucky I got a subscription.
It's the spice of life.
Pretty good. There were a lot of publications writing the trades, writing about how, yeah, this movie made a lot of money on its opening weekend. But let's all calm down, all right?
Not like, that much.
It's not actually yeah. doing...
Minecraft's still around, guys.
Even though it beat Minecraft on its first weekend. Like, it was Minecraft the first weekend, Sinners came out the next weekend, and Sinners upset Minecraft by earning more at the domestic box office. Yeah. And then the next weekend had one of the smallest drops for a film ever. It is the highest grossing original film since Us 6 years ago. It is a film, and of course, both films about the black experience, yeah. you know, and separate from original, separate from IP and established things. Yet everyone or a lot of people in the trades were treating like Ryan Coogler had fucking held a gun to Hollywood's head and was yeah. like, oh, you're fucked. We're not going to get to make movies anymore. But it's like, this is why we'll get to keep making movies like this. It's yeah. insane.
Because people want to go and see original ideas. People want to go to the cinema. People want to experience new things. Marvel fatigue is a real thing. These franchise movies, these IP movies, we're so over it.
Yeah.
Like,
We're back, baby.
Cinema is back.
I think this has done slightly worse than Thunderbolts at the box office. And people are kind of being like, oh, thank God Thunderbolts is kind of doing well. And it's like Sinners is like right behind it, I think. I think Sinners yeah. is like well, 350 right now. Thunderbolts
thinking,
might be a little higher.
If Thunderbolts doesn't do well, then that's our tent pole, right? And then if that falls over, then we have no money to make anything.
But the funny fucking thing is, if I'm writing for one of those publications. If I'm writing, makes me angry. If I'm writing for one of those publications, I would be like, yeah, Thunderbolts made $300 million. That's shit
that's,
for a Marvel movie.
That's
it's
what
not
I mean, like,
doing very well.
What's yeah. expected delivery on these
but
things?
At the lowest end, it's like, yeah, that's okay. Like most of these are meant to make a billion. So
yeah, they want like over 700.
Yeah.
But the last, what, how many five Marvel movies have made really poor money?
Except for Deadpool Wolverine, which absolutely.
Oh, yeah, deservedly.
Yeah, quality.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I see you've come around on that. That's nice.
I heard a song that helped me.
Ben Stiller was the
when
one.
When I come around.
Oh, yuck. Ben Stiller what?
Ben Stiller slammed Variety, but he retweeted their headline. I was like, in what way is this a way to talk about a successful original movie about, what did he say? No, I don't know.
Yeah, well, just
he's
like...
just like, he's like, Variety, what kind of headline is this?
Why is this your narrative? Yeah. Why is it not?
What was the narrative? Sorry,
but they're just like, oh, this film has made some more money than people expected, but it actually needs to make a lot more to break even. So
yeah.
Everyone comes...
No, he's got a point.
They're kind of treating it just like...
Ben Stiller has a point.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
also like, this is a movie helmed by a major black director with a huge black star that's doing well across demographics. But yes, especially that first weekend, I think had a 50% African-American turnout in the States. So it's like, yeah, it feels like you guys are shitting on a certain type of movie at the moment. Yeah. Like, I can't imagine them writing this about a Tarantino film.
But you think about who's in the conversation now. You've still got like Scorsese crops up every now and again. People are still like, you know, this legacy director.
He's great
in the
studio.
Jordan Peele. And Coogler now at the front headlining direction.
But I even think with Coogler, they're like, because Peele came out of the gate with Get Out, won an Oscar, and they're like, all right, well, he's anointed, so he can kind of do whatever. But the attitude was almost like, who does this little fucker Coogler think he is asking for all that? When you're right, they would never say that about Scorsese
Nolan,
right? Because they're like, well, they've earned it. And it's like, yeah, I mean, why? That's a fucking terrible criteria to have. That they need to, if they've made a good movie, who gives a shit? Mm. Who gives a shit?
Anyway. Like Robert Zemeckis, right? He made seven. No, but like, I have a real point.
I was just remembering Here.
That's it. He's made so many good, and he sort of has free reign now. He'll get money to make Here, to make all these, to make Polar Express, to make these ludicrous films that now you're like, what are you doing, man? Just because you have a legacy and just because you made some great films back in the day doesn't mean you still have it.
Polar Express slander. Great movie, right?
No. Don't even play
I'm sorry to go back on it. We've talked about it in so many different pods, but like, as you say, the Marvel fatigue. Yeah. I think really we're really on the cusp of losing it now. I think we're finally moving past it.
Well, people are worried because if Superman is bad, it's like
Can I ask what you mean when we're moving past the fatigue or we're moving past Marvel?
Sorry. What I mean, yeah, we're moving past Marvel. What I think is that we're finally, and I spoke about it in a previous pod, but where the 90s for me is so culturally impactful for what it was doing for films, because everyone was trying new things and there was unique storylines and narratives
and bizarre concept
films. Bizarre concept. And they're all coming through again. I think that we're finally doing, we've come full circle, we've moved past the money machine that is Marvel, and we're getting original filmmakers coming through again. Finally.
Well, I think slowly the studios are realizing that, oh, Marvel, like, just because it's a comic book movie doesn't mean it'll make $1 billion.
No.
Oh, what do we have to do again? Oh, maybe make original film.
That's it.
Like, I mean, it's turning a cruise ship, but it is turning eventually.
And they can modify whatever version worked so quickly that it loses, the bloom goes off the rose. The last one I remember that was like Thor Ragnarok, where everyone was like, oh, they let him do something and it's funny and we all like it. And then Thor Love and Thunder, they were like, what if we never make another one of these?
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
Like, who wants this shit?
Because of this, I want, this sounds really awful, but I want James Gunn's Superman to not do well.
You think it's going to do well?
Yeah. I've seen the trailers, dude, and I think it looks shit.
Yeah.
I think it looks good. I'm excited for it. I'm optimistic for it.
But it's stylized.
James Gunn is a very, very hard horse to bet against right now. I mean, he's the guy who kind of, you know.
Even through the Marvel fatigue, Guardians of the Galaxy
3. He got out of Guardians Galaxy 3, and people could argue that's a pretty self-sustained trilogy. Like, you can't, and it always does well critically and commercially. And he's now a brand. And
I don't
people,
like Guardians of the Galaxy 3, but I think James Gunn has a pretty good hit rate.
I kind of like that movie. I was surprised at how much I liked that movie.
Of course you did.
Anyway, we'll go back to Sinners. So,
I want to talk about one thing about Ryan Coogler while we're in the pantry. Yep. Have you seen the video of him explaining what film he's using and explaining the ratios and explaining why IMAX is great?
No, I should watch that.
He is just the nerdiest guy talking about it. So we did this one on 35mm and then we went up to 90mm and then this is IMAX format, which is 270mm. Mm. And he's just talking about how much scope you get out of the IMAX cameras and how beautiful it is. And
Hear me out. This is why I think it's on your point. Sorry. You've got your Tarantinos, you've got your Cooglers, you've got your even I would say Simon Pegg, for example.
Yeah.
And
these nuffies.
And John Peele.
Yeah.
They're just nerdy fanboys. They love movies.
Oh, right.
They're just huge movie buffs.
Obsessed.
That got a budget, they got a camera, they got a crew, and people believed in their concept.
Yeah, because you hear them talk about it and they're so passionate and they're so knowledgeable.
Yeah.
It's incredible to hear because he spent, I don't know, it's like 8 minutes in this video just talking about film.
Yeah.
And awesome. I was like, this is great.
It's awesome.
This is awesome.
These guys grew up on DVDs. They grew up on DVD commentaries. Yes. So it was the first time they had the chance to hear Martin Scorsese be like, the way we shot this was, you know, and they're just like, fucking great. I know how that's...
Robert De Niro is a bunch in the wall and he's really mad and he missed his life. But we ran out of time.
I'm
obsessed with that moment.
It's bad.
Oh, dear.
I had another point. Ryan Coogler. What was he going to say?
He was talking about film.
Do you know who else is a big film nerd? It's Tom Cruise.
Oh, yeah.
That checks out.
And Tom Cruise is advocating for movies like this. He was at IMAX.
He's posting about it with Michael B. Jordan.
He was doing Barbenheimer. Tom Cruise was a big proponent of that. Mm. Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning has just been out recently. Obviously has made about the same amount of money as this. People expect a bit more from the Mission Impossible franchise than that. But still,
it's a strong fit. It's going well.
Tramiel Tillman in it in an incredible role, and you guys should see it as soon as you can. It's a really good movie.
Going to.
Nowhere as good as this, but it's good.
Can we talk about the credit sequence and the post-credit sequence?
Yes. It is.
Incredible.
One bit I didn't like was how easy the win was for Smoke and who's the young guy again? What's his name?
Sammy.
Yeah. They're in the water and then the sun comes up and then all the vampires die. And you're like,
look.
And I know they've been through the night. They got through it, and that's the thing, and then the sun comes up.
It seems like they cut it pretty – they were fucking around for a while, and they cut it pretty fine.
Even Smoke being the one who shows up at the last second and stabs Remick in the back. I'm like, there are some moments in here where I'm like, I know exactly what's going to happen before it happens. It's still satisfying.
How did he get through the water without being hurt?
I mean, I truly – the third time I watched this, I was like, this is the first time I've had a real problem with this. This makes no sense. There are 50 other vampires on the shore. And he's just, excuse me. And like goes into the water.
He's swimming underwater.
Sure.
Yeah, get it?
That's fine. Yeah. That's fine.
That's fun.
But either way.
Little submarine tactic.
Yes.
Straw.
You don't like how that part ends with Smoke and Sammy, but do you like the post-credit sequence?
I love the post-credit sequence.
I think the movie is nowhere near, or not nowhere near, it really cements, I think, the legacy it's
had. I just didn't see it ending like that either.
No, it's such a brazen choice.
The flash forward.
Yeah.
And it's Buddy Guy.
Buddy Guy!
Buddy Guy.
That's
man.
My buddy guy.
You're so not cool. My guy, buddy.
Just a nice cameo from him.
That's
to be old Sammy That's playing fantastic. In the club.
He's wonderful.
And it's good, like it's that nice sort of, I guess, moral victory that Sammy does go out and do something for himself.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah, well, he carries on the scar, which is, you know, it's symbolism, but it's good symbolism of this experience
Again,
that he's had.
So close to being cheesy. He's got the big scar on his face.
That's it. And, you know, he's got the immortal line and maybe the immortal fucking the thing that Coogler may not ever top for me is, you know, once a week I wake up paralyzed revisiting that night. But before the sun went down, I think that was the best night of my life. Which you're like, oh. Because, and he says, was that like that for you? And Stack says, no doubt, last time I saw my brother, last time I saw the sun. And I was just like, my God. Like, and the way he uses flashbacks artfully, where he shows that shot of Stack seeing Sammy play for the first time again, he shows the two of them watching the sunset.
Because in the bar at the end, they're enemies. Kind of.
I don't know if that's true.
Kind of.
Okay.
But only circumstantially, not morally, because they still love each other, right?
I think they're
still
opposing forces rather
opposing
than
forces. Enemies. Yeah, okay. That works. But then you get the flashbacks like, oh, they loved each other and they had a great time. Isn't that tragic?
Yeah.
It's so nice to see them here and it's amicable. And you're like, oh, okay.
Here's the thing
fine.
As well. It's what appears to be a biracial couple in the 90s. And it's like they can live now. They couldn't do this in the 30s. So it is like they achieve something that was not possible without Remick. You know, it's not a cut and dry case of Remick's a vampire, they're the bad guys. It's his instincts are driven by a cultural desire to overcome those in power, to overcome those that exploit us and to retain some part of who we are, to be part of our ancestry, but also be part of the future. The only problem is you have to be a fucking vampire to do it. And it's like that comes with trade-offs. You can't go out during the day. You have to be someone who
exists.
You have
to feast on human flesh to survive.
like
it's hard.
You have to join the union. Like it's a whole fucking thing.
I'm not hearing any negatives at all.
But yeah.
You got to wear those sweaters.
Great.
I think it is... I don't know if I agree that they're enemies at the end there. I think they've taken those different
tracks. I chose the wrong word.
No, but
you know what I mean.
I guess.
Like of that night before, he would have killed him. He would have eaten him and killed him.
Sure.
Or eaten his neck.
Well, he wanted to...
And friends don't do that.
Friends don't do that.
Yeah. Do you know who else auditioned for Hailee Steinfeld's role?
Who?
Ooh, Halsey. Dua Lipa.
Oh, I love when he says guess and then he doesn't let us guess.
Halsey.
Oh, who cares?
And Oates.
No, here's what's interesting about
okay.
it.
Okay.
Because they were going to call Smoke and Stack Halls and Oates. It's crazy. You know, that. So good.
You remember what you said about laughing?
No, but that was funny.
That was pretty funny.
Yeah, shut up, Tom.
They auditioned Halsey because Halsey and Hailee Steinfeld are, to my mind,
frenemies.
Two of the only white presenting actresses who have black heritage. And that is essential for the role. Mary is a seemingly white passing girl whose grandfather was part black. And it's true with Hailee Steinfeld.
Is it really?
She has. Yeah, oh, I mean, I don't think they would have cast her if it wasn't the case. Because it would have just been like, you're kind of playing a black character. It would be great to have there. But at the same time, it's like Halsey, her, Nicole Richie. Like, it's a short list.
I thought Nicole Richie was adopted.
Nicole Richie was adopted, but one of her paternal parents was still black.
Wow.
So it's one of those things where it's like.
And definitely who I would look at for casting too.
Yeah, so. I mean, it is.
She's great in A Simple Life. Yeah. She's funny lady.
Halsey,
she's
I have actually. I have actually seen Halsey in something. She's in Maxine, you know, the last of X-Men. Yeah. She's really bad in that. So I'm like, I think we dodged a bullet getting
that. Isn't Hailey, she in that show with Machine Gun Kelly?
I don't know.
Oh, Weeds.
My
Weeds.
Gosh.
Hey, should we do MVP?
MVP. You can't say Coogler, though.
What the?
You can't.
Fridge. Frank.
What?
What the fridge, Frank?
Too easy. I can't. Why?
Of course you're all going to say Coogler.
Of course it's Coogler.
I'm going to go with Michael B. Jordan.
Oh, like, okay. I'm not allowed to say Coogler?
Okay, you're allowed to say Coogler now. I thought you were both going to say Coogler. I was like, okay. Boring.
I think Coogler's great. Michael B. Jordan's is performance fantastic. Is, yes, and playing off himself, even when he has that fight at the end.
Although, I'd really like our Irish vampire.
I think
Jack O'Connell, yeah.
Jack O'Connell's
he's
incredible.
Really good.
This is the thing. This cast doesn't miss.
No.
It's an excellent, like, yeah. Even, I think her name's Jamie Lawson, maybe, as Pearline, which is a could easily just be a, we just need, like, a very pretty girl to tempt Sammy. And it's like, she
is the singer. Yeah, she's great.
So gorgeous. She's so good in that one song she has. And the fact that she's just come from something that happened between her and Sammy, I can't remember, it might have been essential to the film. But anyway, she's come from that experience. And
she did come.
Yes.
I've come around.
I'm saying again it, because she's so excited from that encounter from him, she jumps onto the stage. She's like, yeah. You're like, yes, exactly.
I think my MVP will be Miles Caton.
Miles Caton's incredible.
Like, I think the film falls apart without him.
That's a nice, it's a nice intro for him too.
Yeah.
I'm very excited.
Incredible intro.
Learned to play guitar for the film. Couldn't play
before.
I mean,
it's slide guitar. It's in open tuning.
Fucking hell.
Wow.
I know.
So, guys.
This elitist.
You literally just do it. So you're just doing open 5/7. Like, you could do it. You both could do it. You unco motherfuckers.
Put your shirt back on.
Put it on.
My shirt. Anyone throwing anything in?
10.6, I'm staying.
I'm going to go to 10.5.
Yay!
Because it's just so goddamn good. Yeah, absolutely. Me too. I'm going up to
8.5.
888.5. Good stuff.
I can't believe I spilled stuff all over myself.
No, we can.
I can't believe you screamed down the microphone for an hour.
I did do that. I'm sorry.
I can't believe we're
Wait, you can't believe
friends.
That?
Thank you, Ryan Coogler, for bringing cinema back.
Thanks, Coogs.
We're back, baby.
Coogler. The Cougs.
Catch us next week on Throwing the Pow. More episodes coming soon.
Throwing the Pow.
Thank you for listening to Throwing the Pow. My name is Frank.
My name is Marcus.
My name's Tom.
That was Sinners.
Oof, yes, it was.
That was cinema for you sinners out there.
Oh, wow. Cinema.
As if we never made that again, ancient. Send us Instagram, Throwing the Pow, or Throwing the Pow at Gmail, or YouTube, Throwing the Pow, or just tell your friends, Throwing the Pow.
No hate mail.
Throwing the Pow.